14 second and 3106 third, and then work through the work sessions in order. I'm going to try to be encouraging of brief brevity and remarks because we have a very long agenda to get through this morning, and we're going to wrap up by 10. I believe we're on the floor at 10 a.m. So I will now open a public hearing on House Bill 3329. Council Stanford.
Thank you, Chair McPherson, members of the committee. House Bill 3329 relates to the crime of strangulation. Currently, the crime of strangulation is a Class A misdemeanor. House Bill 3329 elevates strangulation to a Class C felony if a child related to the defendant or victim is present, if a dangerous weapon is involved, or if physical injury results. House Bill 3329 also elevates strangulation to a Class C felony if the defendant has a prior conviction for strangulation, a prior conviction for assault or menacing involving the same victim, or at least three prior convictions for assault or menacing or the equivalent crime in other jurisdictions.
Thank you, Council. I understand that Representative Gelser, one of the chief sponsors, is on her way to the hearing room, but let's bring up... Representative Gelser, you are right on time because we have just introduced the bill, and if you're in a position to come up and introduce it to us, then we will have you on first.
I'm a little breathless.
Well, I think it's outstanding how efficiently you were using your time.
You know, I appreciate that very much, and I'm sure that my other committee chair appreciates that as well. We have some more questions. Thank you, Chair Committee, or Chair McPherson and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Representative Sarah Gelser, and I represent House District 16, which includes Corvallis and Philomath down in Benton County. I appreciate the opportunity to testify in support of House Bill 3329. My chief co-sponsor, Representative Patty Smith, is unable to be here today due to illness, but she does send her regrets and says that she has written testimony that you may already have, or it may be on the way. But it was a great privilege to be able to bring this to you in cooperation with Representative Smith and also the co-sponsors that are on the bill. I was very surprised to learn that strangulation is not a felony, that it's a misdemeanor. And as I've talked to constituents and others about the bills that I'm sponsoring this session, and this one comes up, the consistent response that I get back from people is, strangulation isn't a felony. Strangulation is only a misdemeanor. And this is true. I've also been surprised to learn in researching this issue that strangulation has only been considered a crime on its own merits since 2003 when the legislature made that a misdemeanor. Strangulation is one of the most common acts of violence against women in domestic violence situations. It is also frequently used during the commission of rape. Unconsciousness can occur within 10 to 60 seconds, and death can occur within a matter of minutes. When the victim does not die, this act can cause internal injuries that may lead to brain damage, and in some cases, even death, days or weeks after the attack. Strangulation, besides the physical injuries, is a tool of tremendous manipulation, where an abuser gains tremendous power over the person that he is attacking and attempting to control. The repeated use of strangulation is one of the ways these abusers maintain and keep control over their victims. Finally, domestic violence experts know that when an abuser uses strangulation as a method of control, it is an indicator that the situation is likely to become fatal and that he will eventually kill his victim. It only makes sense that such a violent crime would be classified as a felony in certain situations. House Bill 3329 accomplishes this by elevating the crime of strangulation to a Class C felony when the act is committed in front of children, when the perpetrator has previously been convicted of strangulation charges, or when the perpetrator has previously been convicted of violent acts against the same victim. Women who are victimized by rape and domestic violence are often fearful to come forward for help and legal protection. It's difficult for them to seek help, to press charges, and to testify. Enhancing the crime of strangulation to a felony will provide some of these women greater protection from their abusers. It will also underscore the severity of this violation. Strangulation is a serious matter. The law should reflect this. I thank you for considering this bill and urge you to move to a work session today. I hope that on behalf of victims of rape and domestic violence in the state of Oregon and others that may become victims of strangulation, you will move this bill with a due pass recommendation. We have several advocates and other experts in the arena of domestic violence here today who can speak more specifically to why we need to underscore this very serious affront to women and others in the state of Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Gelser. Any questions for the representative? Very good. Thank you very much. And I have several people signed up. And why don't we bring them up in pairs? I have four people on the sign-up list. Let's bring up in pairs Gina Skinner and Jennifer Schindel.
Good morning, Chair McPherson and members of the committee. My name is Gina Skinner. I'm a deputy district attorney in Washington County. I've been a prosecutor now for almost 10 years, and I've primarily focused my attention on the prosecution of domestic violence crimes. I actually sat on the committee prior to the 2003 legislative session when the original strangulation bill was drafted and worked on with a couple other people drafting that original language. We, at that time, actually had the intent of it becoming a felony, and through negotiations, it ultimately passed the legislature as a misdemeanor. We commend this attempt again to try to elevate the crime of strangulation to a felony under certain circumstances. As you've already heard, I will just very briefly give a few comments regarding strangulation. It has historically not been seen as very serious, whether it's by prosecutors or law enforcement, because there are very few signs and symptoms. You can't usually see somebody that's been strangled. They don't have a lot of obvious injuries. They may have some redness. They have made some slight bruising or some scratches. But other than that, other than hoarseness and nausea and dizziness, you're often not going to see much originally when the police arrive. So those cases have very commonly been the offenders have been under arrested and prosecutors have under prosecuted those crimes. As you'll hear in a moment, Jennifer Schindel, who's sitting next to me, she's a forensic nurse, and she'll give you some information about the actual physical short and long term ramifications of victims that have been strangled. The act of strangulation is the ultimate power and control by domestic abusers. It's very psychologically powerful to be able to hold another human being in your hands, showing them physically and verbally that you could and have the ability to kill them at any moment, but at that particular moment you're choosing not to kill them, but they know that at any time if they deviate in their actions from that of the abuser's want, what they want from that victim, that they can do it. Most DV lethality scales use the act of strangulation when ranking how serious the relationship is. So most abusers that go into treatment or by their probation officers, the rate of strangulation is often used as one of the indicators of how dangerous that offender is. A 1999 study done by Gail Strack and George McLean, who is a former assistant city attorney in San Diego and a doctor regarding strangulation, looking at 300 strangulation cases, showed that in those cases there was a history of domestic violence 89% of the time when there was a strangulation that was reported, and 50% of the time children had been present for that strangulation event. And in a 1999 Chicago Women's Health Risk Study, when they're looking at domestic violence homicides, they found that 20% of the domestic violence homicides, strangulation was the cause. In looking at risk factors, they looked back, and if there was a strangulation in the past, it was more likely that there would be future subsequent severe or life-threatening acts 63% of the time to 40% of the time, and the likelihood that they would die ultimately of strangulation if they'd been strangled in the past was 40% to 20%. So finally, we would ask that 10 years after the legislation was passed by this legislature to aggravate assault in the fourth degree, which used to only be a misdemeanor, we added language back in 1997 that would allow that to be a felony under similar circumstances. The legislature found that it was very dangerous for children to witness the sort of violence and the effect that it had on the children emotionally and psychologically. The same effects exist for strangulation. In addition, currently with the misdemeanor as the penalty for strangulation, they can do it again and again and again, and often those cases can't be charged as an assault because we can't prove what physical injury requires under the law. But this aggravation with the multiple strangulation crimes will allow, when the person has a serious history and the victim does need to be safe and the offender needs to be held accountable, they can go to prison. If it's a first-time felony, they are presumptive probation. They will be getting probation. But if it's a multiple times, if they have multiple convictions on the record, then they have the ability to be sent to prison. And if for many cases, that is the only way the victim will escape ultimate death by their abuser. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Skinner. We'll hear from Ms. Schindel and then offer an opportunity for questions.
For the record, my name is Jennifer Schindel. I'm a practicing forensic nurse and deputy medical examiner for Linn and Benton counties. I'm here to tell you a little bit about the effect of strangulation on the human body. The basics are that every cell in your body needs oxygen and blood, and the act of strangulation keeps your body from getting the blood and oxygen that it needs. That's what it comes down to. I almost brought you pictures and diagrams of the neck and all of the major organs and major vessels that go through your neck, but what it comes down to is you have big vessels going to your brain, big vessels coming back from your brain, your airway, which is your source of life, and all of the nerves that go from the brain to your rest of your body. That's what's in your neck. Your neck is pretty darn vital. And any attempt to make this less than a completely heinous, lethal injury are kind of ridiculous, because every single process of your body requires the very oxygen and blood that come from your mouth, your nose, and your neck. Strangulation is different than other injuries that people can inflict on each other, because any swelling or any injury to your mouth, your nose, or your neck are potentially lethal and extremely, extremely dangerous and are considered life-threatening emergencies by the medical community. I almost printed off strangulation statistics for you, but I don't think you need them. 10% of all violent deaths in the United States each year have a component of strangulation. You can die within minutes of being strangled. You can die immediately, or you can die days or weeks down the road. You may or may not have any overt symptoms or signs at the time of the strangulation. That's one important thing. One reason why this bill is important is the prosecutors and the police and the medical community will understand the seriousness of this injury, who may not otherwise. If the police aren't paying attention to it and the prosecutors aren't paying attention to it, the medical community isn't going to pay as much attention to it. It's common sense that we protect our babies from plastic bags over their head, from cords hanging down from the blinds. We put helmets on their heads. All of those things are to protect their airways and to protect their brains. Strangulation injures our airways, injures our brains. It's absolute common sense that this we need to provide protection to people from this manner of that same mechanism of injury. Injuries that can result from strangulation. There is an endless list. You can have laryngeal fractures, fractures of the bones in your neck, upper airway edema, vocal cord mobility, hemorrhage and hematoma, aspiration pneumonitis, miscarriage, anoxic encephalopathy, pulmonary edema. All of these things can be a result. Again, I can say they can show up immediately, they can show up weeks down the road. I have a patient in a hospital right now. She's 24 years old. A man held her up against the wall with a bat and used the bat to strangle her. If he had used that bat to hit her, to beat her about the face, beat her about her body, she'd probably be in pain and suffering, maybe disfigured, may have limited mobility, but she'd be alive. What she is now is she's locked into her body where she can hear everything, feel everything, sense everything, understand everything that's happening, but she can't communicate and she can't move. That bat would have been much less lethal to her if he would have beat her with it. Strangulation is very, 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 very serious. I know of three other women in two other counties right now that are suffering neurological deficits, either neurological in their brain or neurological in the other parts of the body because of strangulation. Again, the reason strangulation is different than other inflicted injury is I can think of very, very few things that one human being can do to another that would be more terrifying or dangerous than strangulation. The sheer number of possible injuries are absolutely overwhelming, and there is no place on your body that's more vulnerable to injury or death than your airway and your neck, and that's exactly what this strangulation is affecting. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Schindel. Are there any questions for either of these witnesses?
Mr. Chair, real quick, thank you. Maybe there's not an answer, but the man you referred to that strangled a lady with a baseball bat, what are the charges that he's facing in that particular situation?
It occurred in another state, and I don't know all the details. I know that they had a really, really pretty high bail set, and they had him on 5 counts of various things, and they dismissed him. And now they're waiting to see if it's going to turn into a homicide.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Yes, sir.
Next, we'll bring up Nancy O'Mara and Tira LaRue.
Hello, for the record, my name is Nancy O'Mara. I'm the executive director at the Center Against Rape and Domestic Violence in Corvallis, Oregon. We serve Linn County and Benton County survivors of domestic violence, sexual assault, and stalking. Thank you for the opportunity to speak today. I have worked as the executive director at the Center Against Rape and Domestic Violence for the last 5.5 years, but I have worked as an advocate in the field of domestic violence and sexual assault intervention for 25 years. All of us working in the field of domestic violence and sexual assault intervention and support services have long recognized strangulation as an exceedingly high risk factor for serious injury or death for those survivors with whom we work. I glanced at our most recent case notes regarding clients with us at this time and jotted down some notes for you. It's in the written testimony that you have. Abuser violates restraining order. Police are called. Abuser violates restraining order a second time. He strangles victim, throws her down. She sustains a fractured rib and has breathing difficulties. Victim, year-old child, and abuser are all in the same room when abuser grabs client by her neck and throws her across the room. She suffers severe neck injury from the throw and the force on her neck. Victim strangled by her abuser on more than 100 occasions. She knows this is how he will kill her. She wants to get away. She calls police and shelter after the most recent assault. Abuser holds victim's face to pillow after he steps on her chest and assaults her. The pillow did impair the victim's breathing. Strangulation presents a profound risk of fatality for survivors of domestic violence and sexual assault, victims of domestic violence and sexual assault. It's absolutely essential that the crime of strangulation be enhanced to reflect that risk. Please support House Bill 3329 and enhance the penalties for the crime of strangulation.
Thank you, Ms. O'Mara. We'll hear from Ms. LaRue and then to offer quite an opportunity for questions to both of you.
My name is Tara LaRue. Good morning, Chair McPherson and members of the committee. I work as a sexual assault victim advocate with Community Works in Jackson County. I've been working with victims of domestic and sexual violence in some capacity for 12 years. During this time, I have heard over 3,000 stories of violence and victimization. Today, I would like to share with you a couple of excerpts from the stories of two Oregon survivors of strangulation. The first is from a survivor who was recalling when her husband strangled her over 30 years ago. When I asked her to write about the experience, she told me that her throat constricted and the horror was still with her after all those years. These are her words. "It came fast and was the most terrifying experience of my life. Oh my God, I'm going to die this time. I am scared, I am pleading, I am praying. I am on my knees, but I am very quiet. I do not want my children to hear me die. Now it hurts to breathe, and I can no longer speak, but I can pray. I don't know why it stopped, but I was fortunate and only had to wear turtlenecks for a short time this time." The second is from a young woman who was strangled by her partner 2 years ago. These are her words. "There were times when he would hold me down and pin me to the ground. When I tried to fight and get out of his grip, he would put his hands on my throat, strangling me to keep me on the ground. He would threaten me to do what he said, or I would see what would happen. As incidents like this went on, they kept getting worse. I was more and more afraid of him. I did not know if one of these days would be my last. I thought he would kill me. These two women lived in fear and believed they were going to die at the hands of their husbands. I've heard variations of these stories over and over from domestic and sexual violence victims. Strangulation is an all too common tactic used by offenders to gain control and immediate compliance. Victims of strangulation report being terrified that they were going to die and disbelief that the offender was able to look them in the eye, cut off their airflow, and watch them gasp for breath. On behalf of these two survivors and hundreds of others, thank you for the opportunity to testify today.
Thank you, Ms. LaRue. Any questions for either of these witnesses? And thank you very much for being here. That concludes all the witnesses who are signed up on House Bill 3329. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3329 and open a work session on House Bill 3329. Members, this bill has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means, because there is a fiscal impact whenever we're elevating the penalty for this kind of offense, or for any offense, but it is obviously it's serious matter, and as a policy choice aside from the Ways and Means process, it seems like this is something that ought to move forward, and our budgetary people have to decide then what the cost impacts of it would be.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3329 to the Ways and Means with a due pass.
Representative Barker moves House Bill 3329 with a due pass recommendation for referral to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Any discussion of that motion? If not, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Bonamici.
Aye.
Representative
Hamlin. Aye.
Representative
Horace. Aye.
Representative Cox.
Aye.
Representative Krieger.
Aye.
Representative Reed.
Aye.
Vice Chair Barker.
Aye.
Vice Chair Wisnik.
Aye.
Chair McPherson.
Aye.
House Bill 3329 moves to the Committee on Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation. I will close the work session on House Bill 3329. Do we have this bill here for 3106?
Oh, see on 3106?
Yeah.
Well, let's go to 314.
That's the one we do.
We do have
the first bill if you're going to do it.
So, should we get 3106 first?
Yeah.
All right. Here we go.
We're going to change the order slightly between the two other hearings. There are some further just technical amendments that we're hoping to have in hand on House Bill 3314. So instead, we're going to go to a public hearing on House Bill 3106, which I'll open now.
Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3106 comes to you from Representative Shields at the request of the Oregon American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. It requires the Board of Public Safety Standards and Training to ensure that police, reserve, and corrections officers are trained to recognize indicators of mental illness, substance abuse, and other disabilities in persons and apply risk assessment, de-escalation, and crisis intervention techniques. Requires that the training be no less than 40 hours of in-person instruction. As chair, members of the committee, to the best of my knowledge, there are no amendments to the bill.
We have several witnesses signed up on House Bill 3106, and we'll hear from Michael Morris first.
Good morning, Chair McPherson and members of the committee. My name is Mike Morris, and I'm the Addictions and Mental Health Policy Manager with Addiction and Mental Health Division, Department of Human Services. I'll keep my comments very brief. I have written testimony that I'll submit to you. Just with the awareness in the recent history of some very tragic events is we are very much in support of increased training of law enforcement officers in regards to how to approach and work with and de-escalate a situation with a person with a mental illness, and we support this bill that adds or requires 40 hours of training. And thank you for the opportunity to testify. I would be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Ms. Morris, we're going to have a work session here a little later on a bill that we had heard before that had a minimum hour requirement for dealing with mental illness, and this looks like it has an overlap with that that proposal. Are you familiar enough with the other to be able to give us a sort of the picture as to how the two relate to each other?
On House Bill 2765, I believe that one increases the hours to, or ensures that 24 hours are provided in training. This bill would require 3106 requires 40 hours of training in mental health. We would support either direction because we see them both as being a step to increasing the training, the initial training regarding mental illness. We also, that has been testified on that bill, is really the importance of follow-up training at the local level through crisis intervention team training is also critical, and many of the jurisdictions are now implementing that training for their officers.
Okay, any questions, committee?
Well,
Representative Wisdom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sorry, I missed it. So you're from the Department of Corrections or the DPSST?
So we're going to hear it next from.
Okay, I'll wait.
Somebody from DPSST.
I'll wait. Thank you.
This is from the Mental Health Division of DHS.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay, if there are no further questions, then thank you, Mr. Morris. Cameron Campbell from DPSST.
Good morning, Chair McPherson, members of the committee. My name is Cameron Campbell. I'm the Director of Training for the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training. The agency does not take a position with regard to this bill particularly. You may recall from my testimony on House Bill 2765, we had a discussion around the 40 hours of training and what crisis intervention team training is really all about. And the agency, of course, is in support of 2765. This particular bill sort of places the burden on the agency to ensure 40 hours of in-person training, and that means that wireless or internet training or CD ROMs or things like that would not be appropriate for this type of training, and that training needs to be delivered to all public safety officers across the state. That would take a fairly substantial amount of time to accomplish. There are anywhere between 25 and 28,000 public safety officers across the state, all of whom would need to take that 40 hours of training, and those classes would be logistically very difficult. As you know, the department has a regional and advanced training component to it, although that section of the agency was cut pretty substantially in 2003, and there have been no restorations to that section since then. This would be a large burden on that section of the agency. There would be a fairly substantial fiscal impact to this particular bill, although the agency supports the increase in mental health awareness training for public safety officers across the state. We are actively engaged with the mental health community. I attend the mental health caucus meetings every Thursday morning that Senator Abel Gordley sponsors so that we can open and be engaged as full partners with the mental health community. I'm not certain that this bill would necessarily get us where we all want to be. I am certainly willing to take any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Campbell. Any questions? Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Campbell, for coming back. Do you see much difference in what would be offered under the two bills? There's a little bit of a difference in the descriptions of them, but in practically speaking, in the courses that would be offered, is there going to be a substantive difference between 2765 and 3106?
Chair McPherson and Representative Bonamici, there is a difference in that the 2765 is offered at the basic training level, and it would be offered to all officers taking the basic training. That, of course, does not address the thousands of officers who are already out on the street, and I do believe that those officers need additional training. If the intent of this bill is to have this 40-hour training delivered at the basic training level, I can tell you that we do not have the physical infrastructure in place to make that happen. We would need additional dorm rooms. We would need additional classrooms because the academy was built to be minimally adequate in terms of dorm rooms and classrooms to support the training mission that we currently have. This bill would require that each of those training programs be increased by at least 1 week to accommodate that 40 hours of training. And so that would require an increase in the infrastructure, the physical infrastructure at the academy in order to meet the requirements of this bill. If the intent of the bill is that this training, as I said, be delivered in a regional setting, that there is also a fiscal impact to that, in that we would need at least one additional coordinator on the regional training side and additional resources to get the instructors to make this happen. And it would take time to get all of the officers trained. 40 hours of in-person classes, you know, you figure the average size class is 40 officers per class, and you're talking about 25,000 or so public safety officers.
A follow-up, Mr. Chair?
You may.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I also want to find out about the focus of the bill. 2765 talks about recognition of mental illness using a crisis intervention training model. And 3106 talks about mental illness, substance abuse, and other disabilities. And so I wonder if the scope of 3106 is broader, or do you see the substance abuse and other disabilities wrapped up within the recognition of mental illness utilizing a crisis intervention training?
Chair McPherson and Representative Bonamici, it is broader, although in most of the time in the context of that training, the other issues are brought into that training as well. It is very difficult to conduct training that is single focused on just a single issue. You have to bring in the ancillary issues to the problem when discussing mental illness and in any kind of mental illness training. You will bring those other issues into that training as well.
Thank you.
Representative Flores.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Cameron, does DPSST lend any type of training support to the counties that have crisis intervention training in place right now?
Chair McPherson and Representative Flores, we do if they ask for it. Most of the crisis intervention teams that are in place, Portland, Clackamas County, Washington County, they're doing that on their own. And they're in large urban areas, and they have the infrastructure in place, and they have training divisions and so on in order to be able to accomplish this training. And they bring in the local mental health community as partners in the training. That is what makes crisis intervention team training so successful, is that it is delivered on a local level, and you're drawing from the local resources, and you are building partnerships between the officers who take the training and the providers of that training, and you're putting a local face to the issue. It is also why we do not advocate the delivery of that full 40-hour training in basic training, and that's because you're not getting that. We would be drawing from the resources available here in Salem. That would be much different than the resources available in Eastern Oregon or Southern Oregon or pretty much any other community, because the mental health delivery system is unique geographically from one community to the other. It's important, we believe, to have that training delivered on a local geographic area so that you're drawing those resources and making those connections and building those partnerships between the officers and the service deliverers.
Thank you.
Representative Bark.
I've had experience trying to schedule in Portland for in-service training, and for small numbers of people, it would seem to me this would be virtually impossible for you to give every officer in the state 40 hours of training on this. I don't know how, with the shifts, and then they've got somebody sick one day or they got to go to court part of the time. It would seem to me it would just be a huge, huge expense to be able to try to do that. I don't even think you could do it. I mean, it just seems like that would be an impossible.
Well, Chair McPherson and Vice Chair Barker, it would be a monumental task. It would, as I say, take many years to accomplish. It is not a quick fix. Because of the issues that you've mentioned and others, it would take a substantial amount of time to get all officers trained to that level. And there's also the question of whether or not it is appropriate to train all officers to that level.
Thank you.
Any further questions of Mr. Campbell? If not, thank you, Mr. Campbell.
Thank you,
Chair. We have next, Mary Botkin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Mary Botkin, representing the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. We've already accomplished what we wanted to with this bill. We got the debate and the discussion started. And the frustration that we have is that nobody is doing any sort of consistent mental health intervention training right now. And DPSST is struggling to try and figure out if they have the resources to do it. In talking with Representative Shields, he shared the concern of our organization, which is that there did not seem to be any sort of focus by DPSST to move into this area, and we saw more and more tragic outcomes with interactions between law enforcement, corrections, and the mentally ill due to nobody's fault. One of the cases that I dealt with was an individual in one of our prisons who suffered from a psychotic break, and in the interactions of the officers, they were not trained to know that pepper spray was virtually ineffective on someone who is in the midst of a psychotic episode. All the pepper spray did was compromise his upper respiratory system, and subsequently the inmate passed as a result of having a compromised airway. The officers just didn't know. And this is not okay for us. It's traumatic for the officers who do everything right and for the family members of the inmate who just don't understand why they weren't trained to handle it better. The officers don't understand why they weren't trained to handle it better. You know, there's no magic numbers here. 40 hours, 20 hours, 10 hours, 4 hours. 4 hours is what we're getting now in service training. And it's not sufficient. And I testified on 2765, said that, you know, there's no magic fix here. This is a budget issue. It's a matter of how much can we afford to do. Do we train existing public safety officers? Yeah, I think we do. But do we do it immediately? Probably not. Do we do it on some sort of a rolling process? Maybe. The issue is the legislature needs to send a clear and distinct message that it is your policy that mental health training and proper intervention be a policy for the state of Oregon for all public safety officers, not to ignore their needs in knowing how to properly interact with this growing number of members in our community. These folks are on our streets. We need to handle them appropriately, and we need to have good interactions. And I don't know any other way to do it but training. So whether it's this bill or 2765 or whatever, I know that 2765 is going to move forward. This bill has a great relating to clause. You know, it's having been in the building a long time, I always look at the relating to clause. This has an open-ended one. It can do anything, but it has to deal with training. And so I don't know, you know, what you want to do with this bill. We're not married to anything, any of the words on the paper. We're married to the idea that we need mental health training for public safety officials. Thank you.
Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for coming back, Ms. Botkin. When you were here testifying on 2765, you thought that it should be, instead of police officers, public safety officers. And do you have any idea how that change might affect the numbers? From if 2765 the concept of 2765, which is admittedly more narrow than 3106, mm-hmm. but if it were expanded to include public safety officers, we're talking about twice as many people, four times as many people.
The experts behind me say three times as many.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Thank you, Ms. Botkin.
Thank you.
Our final signed-up witness on House Bill 3106 is Megan Coy. Go ahead.
Chairman McPherson, members of the committee, thank you very much for allowing me to testify in favor of House Bill 3106. My name is Megan Cahay. I'm very happy to be here. I am someone who has had over 30 years of experience as a mental health consumer. I've been hospitalized over 100 times. I've had several different kinds of shock treatment. I've been in hospital seclusion rooms and four-point restraint. Over the last 8 years, I've been in recovery, and now I have the great pleasure of serving my community as a peer advocate. Over the course of my lifetime, I've known the experience of having my behavior bring me in contact with law enforcement officers. So I have a personal stake in this bill. I want it to pass because I want law enforcement officers to have additional training. I've had both positive experiences with the officers that I came in contact with, and then I had some experiences where I was handled with less skill. And so when I think about what more training would mean, it comes in a very personal form of my personal experience. Some of the sheriffs that I came in contact with had a very natural talent for dealing with someone who was very upset, and I'm very grateful to some sheriffs that I got to know personally because they were compassionate and naturally skilled, and they helped me through some rough times because they were kind of, they naturally knew what to do. I think just out of their own personalities more than anything else. But there were a couple instances when I was in police custody that things were fairly rough, and I think that if the officers would have had some more training, it would have been a very useful thing for both myself and for the officers that were in a very difficult situation, not knowing how to deal with someone who was in a psychotic crisis. So this bill is a good bill, I believe. It goes in the right direction. Now, I've heard some talk this morning saying the logistics of this bill are impossible, but I don't believe things are simply impossible. You are leaders, and we must have a vision to transform our systems. And if things are thought to be impossible, then they simply become impossible. But if we have a vision to transform our systems, and think in terms of transformation and have the expectation that we will find solutions and not stop at just looking for dead-end streets, but think in transformational ways as problem solvers, then I think we'll find the answers because we'll be looking for new solutions. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Cahay. We really appreciate your coming forward and putting a human face on these challenges that our law enforcement people face.
You're welcome. If there are any questions, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Are there any questions? Thank you, Ms. Cahay.
You're welcome.
Those are all the people who are signed up on House Bill 3106. So I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3106. I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2765. And committee, the reason for doing that is so that we can focus back on 2765 and also think about maybe at the same time it's the relationship to what we just heard on House Bill 3106.
Chairman of the committee, House Bill 2765 comes to you from Representative Lim and Olson and Senator Gordley. It compels the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training to require at least 24 hours of training in mental illness recognition using a crisis intervention training model. Requires training to include 12 hours classroom and 12 hours scenario training.
And Council, we have some dash one amendments which would delete the 12 and 12 requirement. And what I'd like to do is to invite Mr. Campbell from PPSST forward to, although I didn't alert him in advance, I was expecting that, but Mr. Campbell, I wanted to get your comments on the dash one amendment, which would delete the 12 and 12 requirement, so the bill would require at least 24 hours of training in the recognition of mental illnesses utilizing a crisis intervention training model, period. And that would be the end of the bill. And I've been told by Representative Lim that with that change, that DPSST is supportive or at least not opposed to the bill.
Chairman McPherson, we do support the bill with the dash one amendment, and it has no fiscal impact to us. We can easily accommodate the provisions of the bill as we are functioning today, and look forward to being able to do that.
Representative Barker,
thank you, Mr. Campbell. On as you heard on the other bill, they talked about the public safety, so that we'd include the prison guards. Would that work as well in this one if we were to change police officer to public safety officer?
That would be a little bit more difficult, Vice Chair Barker. I'm sorry. It would be a little bit more difficult in that that would require a change to the corrections curriculum. They currently do not have. They do not receive that same quantity of hours. They don't receive as much scenario training. The corrections curriculum is currently going through revision. There is a corrections curriculum advisory committee that has been constituted by the board through its policy committee. And their job is to take a look at the corrections curriculum and revamp it or make recommendations back to the board and the agency on whether or not they're receiving sufficient amount of time. Again, that takes us back to the issue of infrastructure, in that any addition in time to the curriculum does one of two things. We can add the time after hours during the evening and still maintain the class within that five-week that they're on campus time frame for corrections. However, that incurs overtime liability to the sending agencies, particularly impacted by that would be the Department of Corrections. Their officers, they receive overtime for anything over 8 hours a day. And so if we keep them in session and run night classes to accommodate that provision, that would incur overtime to the Department of Corrections. If we keep them beyond the 5 weeks, that brings in the infrastructure problem in dorm room space, classroom space, so on.
And just a brief follow-up, if I may. So when you're looking at revamping it, then you don't need a law to add more mental health time. Is that right? I mean, when they look at this thing, say, you know, we need to pick that up a little bit. The police are going to have 12 hours, and we need to. So if we pass this bill, you could still accommodate that without us having to change this.
Well, Chair McPherson, Representative Barker, we can in that, but other things will have to drop off.
Yeah.
For the police side, we can, no problem.
Yeah.
For the corrections officers, there we would need to adjust the curriculum,
yeah.
And so there would be less hours in other topical areas. I can tell you that I presided over the most recent graduation of corrections officers this past Friday, was reviewing their exit surveys. They complete surveys on a daily basis, and then they complete an exit survey before they graduate, and was really surprised to see how many of the officers going through the training actually indicated that they needed more time at the academy. They felt that additional time on topics would be very beneficial to them. That is, of course, a budgetary issue.
Great, thank you.
Representative Kopp.
Thank you, Chair McPherson. My question is just to make sure I understand the difference between the two bills. 2765 deals with officers in training before they get out in the field. And the other bill is about everybody. I have a concern about all those that are out there that could use a little additional training. I don't know what the suggestion might be, but I think some of the incidents that Ms. Blackman was talking about and referring to are officers that have been out there. So I don't know what the solution is. But
Representative Cameron.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just real quickly, maybe this is for Ms. Blackman to answer, but the situation that was brought up about the officers that use the mace, is there an opportunity on an annual basis for our prison officers to be able to go back and have more training, and could this be included in some of that ongoing training that they receive or don't receive, I guess would be the question.
Mm-hmm. Well, Chairman Pearson, Representative Cameron, the Department of Corrections does do in-service training, and in fact their professional development unit, which is their training division, is located on the campus of DPSST. Their offices are located there, and they in fact have a dedicated classroom for their in-service training. It is something that could be done on an in-service basis. Again, for the Department of Corrections, that would be logistically probably difficult. It would be more appropriate, perhaps, for them to deliver it within the individual institutions. Yeah. But I don't want to comment for the Department of Corrections. But I think it does bear sort of saying that training does not always get you the results that you're looking for. As the late, and I'm sorry I don't remember her name, so eloquently stated, she encountered officers who were very, very compassionate towards her, and that's based on the individual. I'm not sure that there is any amount of training that gets a person there. You're either that kind of person or you're not, and that's why I sort of earlier referenced that it's questionable as to whether or not this is appropriate for all officers. If Major Sam Cochran, who is the founder of the crisis intervention team concept in Memphis, along with the mental health partners that he was working with, he emphasizes the point that this should not be delivered to all officers, that the officers who receive this training should volunteer for this. They should be screened for this. They should be officers who have that type of compassion and who respond to those situations. They receive specialized training. It is what makes them special. Their motto is special people deserve special officers.
Mr. Campbell, I've just been alerted that we have only 45 minutes left for our agenda today, and we've got a long agenda here yet to go. So I would say if there are questions of either Mr. Campbell or Ms. Botkin that we need to have here, we're in work session now on House Bill 2765, then if you really, in order to inform a decision, if you have questions, let's go forward. But otherwise, I think we need to proceed. The way I would see it, committee, is that we have House Bill 2765, which really doesn't make any change. The DPSST is already doing this with the -1 amendments. They're already doing this. I think I'm understanding from the nod from Mr. Campbell that that's already happening. So it would be a statement of principle about something that is already being done, hence no fiscal impact. House Bill 3106, which we're developing our thinking about, would have a fiscal impact as a subsequent to Ways and Means, so if we felt it was important to do that, we would be moving it down the road to another step in the process, but it would have a significant fiscal impact.
So at that point, I guess I'd throw it open for comments from the or the committee or a motion on House Bill 2765. Representative Lepores.
First, Mr. Chair, in regard to 2765, just like to have our committee members recall a written testimony from National Alliance on Mental Illness Oregon, which indicated that those areas that do have the crisis intervention team training, those are specifically local projects, and officers receive 40 hours of training in their communities. I know it's a very successful model in Clackamas County, Portland, and as Mr. Cameron indicated, other areas. I think the statement of principle is very important, and I would be very encouraged to have this bill move forward and not have it die in the Ways and Means vine. So in that context,
when we say this bill, you're talking about
2765.
2765 does not have a subsequent to Ways and Means.
That's right. And so the other bill would, in
yes.
fact, die on the vine. So
yeah.
I would like to have this statement of principle at least
okay.
go
okay.
forward.
Okay. Then that what would suggest then moving the dash one amendments into House Bill 2765.
Right. Go ahead.
I just wanted to clarify something because the staff measure summary says that currently there's 8 hours of classroom training, 4 hours of mixed classroom, and four to eight hours of scenario training. So I don't know if there's some, it sounds to me like there's at least some increase of a few hours in 2765. Is that correct?
Senator Bonamici, that is correct. Our intent is to increase the number of scenarios that an officer goes through as part of their scenario training to include additional scenarios that have a mental health component in order to meet the requirements of the bill.
Thank you.
But Mr. Campbell, it does not have a subsequent to Ways and Means on it. Are you comfortable with that?
I am, because the officers go through about 40% or more of the additional 6 weeks of training is scenario training. We have, of course, the latitude within that scenario training of deciding what those scenarios are comprised of, because what we're doing is testing their and giving them the ability to practically apply what they've learned. We would simply increase the number of scenarios that they would go through that have a mental health component to them.
Okay. Is there a motion then on the dash one amendment?
Mr. Chair, I move dash ones into 2765.
Okay, Representative Barker moves the dash one amendments into House Bill 2765. Is there any discussion? Any objection? The dash one amendments are in.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2765 to the floor with a due pass.
Representative Barker moves House Bill 2765 as amended by the dash one amendments to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Mr. Chair, just to reemphasize, this is leaving out a population of corrections officers that was referred to, and I think down the road we need to encourage the Department of Corrections to make sure that those people are getting the training that they need, and possibly down the road as DPSST is revamping their training, that they look at this too as well.
Thank you, Representative. There's no further discussion. The clerk will call the roll.
Representative Bonamici. Aye. Representative Cameron.
Aye.
Representative Flores.
Aye.
Representative Cobb.
Aye.
Representative Krieger.
Aye.
Representative Reed.
Aye.
Vice Chair Barker.
Aye.
Vice Chair Resnick.
Aye.
Chairman Person.
Aye. House Bill 2765 is amended, moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and I suggest we offer Representative Lim the opportunity to carry that, and if he doesn't, then we'll may approach one of you committee members to do so. Before I close that work session, then, committee, we have House Bill 3106 with a big fiscal attached to it before that going to open the work session on it, so we have the opportunity to roll that over if need be. What is there a desire to try to move forward with that bill?
Mr. Chair, that bill, I just in rough numbers, is 1 million hours of training for the state, and it just I don't know how they could do that this time, and for us to impose that on them without coming up with the bucks to pay for it.
Yeah, I understand. Okay, committee, I will close the work session on House Bill 2765 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3314. Council Taylor.
Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3314 comes to the committee in judiciary at the request of the Bicycle Transportation Alliance. My staff member summary addresses the dash one amendments. You just got, just out of Legislative Council's office, the dash two amendments to really address some technical issues. Creates the Class A traffic infraction of infliction of serious physical injury or death to a vulnerable user of a public way with a fine of $12,500. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the bill as originally drafted would have made it a Class A misdemeanor. It defines infractions occurring when a person operates a vehicle, not a motor vehicle, a vehicle carelessly or recklessly upon a highway and causes serious physical injury or death to the vulnerable user of a public way. It defines vulnerable user of a public way as a pedestrian, a person riding an animal, or a person operating any of the following in a public way, crosswalk or shoulder of the highway, farm vehicle, skateboard, roller skates, inline skates, bicycle. Subject the guilty driver of the motor vehicle to suspension of driving privileges requires the Department of Motor Vehicles to suspend the driving motor vehicle for up to 1 year, creates a driving improvement program for those charged with inflicting serious physical injury or death to a vulnerable user of a public way.
Okay, let's have Scott Bricker, and it says in panel. So, Mr. Bricker, and I don't know if the rest of others are on this list or not.
Yeah, we'll. Thank you, Chairman, members of the committee. We'll start with myself and Doug Parrow. Then there's some other folks that will come up. And so, again, Chairman McPherson, members of the committee. My name is Scott Bricker, and I'm the representative of the Bicycle Transportation Alliance, and today the Willamette Pedestrian Coalition, both nonprofit organizations that are working to increase safety in Oregon's roadways for bicyclists, pedestrians, trying to increase physical activity, and working in Portland statewide bicycle safety education programs, safe route school programs, traffic safety work. House Bill 3314 is an effort that we've been working on for a year now, and it's and we're just got -2 amendments about 2 seconds ago. So that it's been an interesting process so far for us. The concept behind this bill, and you'll hear some really compelling testimony today, is that traffic safety is a primary concern for bicyclists, for walkers, and other vulnerable users of the roadway, and for everyone. When the research that we've done over the last 3 years of the Bicycle Transportation Alliance has found that even among current cyclists, people who have been riding for years, that riding their bicycles around vehicles, that traffic safety is a top issue for them, that restricts their use, and we're hoping to build programs that will help increase that safety. The statistics are compelling. In the nation, over 42,000 people a year die on our roadways. In Oregon, traffic fatalities and traffic crashes are the top cause of fatality and serious injury for every age group from 1 to 34. And for children ages 5 to 9, pedestrian crashes are a top cause. Children 10 to 14, bicycle crashes. In 2005, there were 444 fatalities on the roadway, almost 20,000 injuries, almost 45,000 crashes, and exceeded an economic loss of $1 billion over the course of that year, falling squarely coming out of our pocketbooks. We propose this bill because in recognition that the law offers a variety of ways to prosecute people that get into crashes, whether it's a bicyclist operating or driver operating. But in many cases, and there are many cases of times where a driver will seriously injure or kill a person on the roadway and will actually be careless or even sometimes reckless, and these are pretty aggravated bars, and receive merely a violation, sometimes not even having to show up in court, apologize, go to a traffic safety program, do any kind of community service, or give back for healing. So we have a bill that we'd like to talk about today. Doug Parrow, who's a member of the BTA's board and our legislative committee, helped craft the bill. As you know, we have a -1 amendment that we've been working on. A -2 amendment just came in, which were some technical issues that committee council has done for us. And well, there may be a couple of other things we'd like to talk about as well, but I'll introduce Doug Parrow. Thanks.
Mr. Parrow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Doug Parrow. I am a member of the Bicycle Transportation Alliance Board of Directors. I live at 6782 Amy Lane in Kaiser, just north of Salem here. I will talk about the bill in the context of the bill in combination with the amendments, if it's okay, Mr. Chair, because As I think most people know, the bill that was introduced at our request did have some fairly significant issues associated with it. One of those was that as the bill was crafted by Legislative Council after we put the concept in, the bill did not require or establish any level of culpability on the part of the operator of a motor vehicle in terms of allowing their vehicle to come into contact with a vulnerable user. That was simply not our intent. And one of the things that that we've been working hard with a number of people on is to identify and to establish what that level of culpability is that should be required in order for the operator of a vehicle to be charged with the violation now causing serious physical injury or death to a vulnerable user. And in working with committee staff and the Legislative Council and with a number of other people, where we have landed there is that that level of culpability should be that the operator of the vehicle be operating that vehicle in a careless or reckless manner. And those are concepts that are already in the statutes. There's already language related to careless driving. There's already language related to reckless driving. So there is a current level, the concepts around careless and reckless driving, and we have tied into those. So fundamentally what the bill does then is to create an enhanced penalty, if you will, then, for somebody who, in the commission of existing traffic violation, that be careless driving or reckless driving, who causes serious injury or death to a vulnerable user of a roadway. Now, I note that in that concept also, it speaks to all vehicles. So a bicyclist who, as a result of their carelessness or recklessness, cause serious injury or death to a vulnerable user of a roadway, also would be subject to these enhanced penalties. One of the other, I think, essential elements of the bill, as we have tried to work on it, is it does increase, it does establish a fairly significant enhancement in terms of the penalty, a fine and suspension of driver privileges for a period of time. That's not really the focus, though, of what we want to accomplish with this bill. What we are more interested in is moving the violators of this particular violation into the driver improvement program. And so Section 2 of the bill really speaks to establishing the violation. Sections 3 to 10, then, deal with the process whereby an individual who has been charged with causing serious injury or death to a vulnerable user, the process by which that enhanced penalty would be suspended on their successful completion of a driver improvement program. And that driver improvement program fundamentally would be training in terms of the responsibility of vehicles around vulnerable users. It would be completion of community service, and it would be testing to demonstrate that, in fact, the vehicle operator is competent to operate motor vehicles. So fundamentally, Mr. Chair, that is the concepts and the approach that we are proposing. We have been working hard with ODOT and with others to minimize the fiscal impact of that. We believe that we are there in terms of not having a significant impact, but there may be some additional work that needs to be done to address that particular issue.
Thank you, Mr. Perro. Representative Krieger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We don't have an engrossed bill. We just now saw the dash two, so I don't see how it quite fits together. Maybe some general questions. It talks about vulnerable user, and then it says means, pedestrian, flagger, highway worker, on and on. And I know that flaggers that are employed on highways and highway workers, state and county, city, are all given training on this type of safety when they're out there, how they conduct themselves out there. But when I go down and look at skateboard, online skaters, roller skaters, an electric personal assistance device, all of those people, what training are they getting mandatory training do they have to have in order to be on the highways?
Mr. Chair, Representative Krieger, there is no required, the short answer is there is no required training to use a skateboard or a bicycle or walk on our roadways for that matter. The bicycle, although in fact there is a statute that says that there is a bicycle safety education program that ODOT must run if finances are available, and as you can imagine, finances are rarely available for that program. It just hasn't been prioritized as something that we should be running. However, the Bicycle Transportation Alliance and the Alignment Pedestrian Coalition have been working very hard on those types of efforts. We have a Safe Routes to School program that we passed legislation about in 2001 and 2005 and worked on the federal level to create funding for that. And in fact, there's a $4.4 million program at ODOT currently that will be spent over the next 3 years. In the last year, we taught 5,500 children how to ride bicycles safely in a 10-hour program. We run a variety of efforts. We partner with the City of Portland, with ODOT, with many community members. There is a lot of work that we're trying to do to get that information out there in the community. And so this is a priority for us. Currently, there is no requirement to have a license to walk, bicycle, skateboard, and as you can imagine, for children, you know, playing on the street, whatnot, which this may encompass. So these are things that we hope to encourage to happen in our community.
Go ahead.
Earlier, I believe you gave testimony about the number of fatalities in Oregon. How many fatalities were there specifically to those listed classes other than flaggers and highway workers?
Mr. Chair, Representative Krieger, approximately 15% of the users in any given year, of the people who are killed in Oregon are vulnerable users of the roadway. So the number is 50 or 60 approximately every year. Of that, we're probably targeting, you know, we're probably looking at perhaps half of that number are cases where we're really saying that there was careless behavior of an operator of any type of vehicle, and where that operator received citations but no additional program. So we're looking at a fairly small program at this point, an opportunity to try something out that we think is a way to create healing and education in the community.
You kind of got at, but of those fatalities that you said there was 50 or 60 or 40 or 50, you don't know what percentage of those was actually caused by the vehicle, or was there a contributing factor when you look at that number from the people on these, you know, this vulnerable users?
Mr. Chair, Representative Krieger, I don't have all the data and statistics of every person, and there are an ODOT DMV does keep that type of data, and ODOT is here today. There are a variety. The general number is approximately, you know, there's a certain percent, typically 40%. When you look at, if you're just saying ballpark, approximately 40% of the of, say, the vulnerable users would be at fault. So if there were 100 deaths in a year, you might say 40% of those deaths, there was some fault attributed. These are ballpark statistics, if you forgive that. So 60% might be the operator of the vehicle. They're really, every case is going to be individual, as you can imagine.
Follow up?
Go ahead.
Is the fight of 12,500 still in the bill?
Yes, it's in the dash two amendments, compared to the dash one as well, and you'll find it on in the dash twos on line 16.
Okay, I see it there now. Some of these individuals who are operating skateboards and that are juveniles, would they be subjected to a $12,500 fine if they were found to be at fault?
Mr. Chair, Representative Krieger, any operator of a vehicle under this bill, any operator of a vehicle on the roadway that seriously injured or killed a vulnerable user of the roadway and was found to be careless or reckless would be subject to this fine and a license suspension, which in this case perhaps wouldn't apply, or go into this program. And so as what we're trying to do is set a bar that encourages people to go into the program.
Go ahead, Bob. Well, we're running out of time to get the number of people forward, so if we could...
Well, I could be on for an hour here, but I'm asking specifically, 14-year-old boy on roller skates, he crosses the street, is 100% cause of the accident, is he going to be subjected to the $12,500 fine, or only a vehicle who causes the accident?
Well, I think council can answer that.
Chair, members of the committee, a couple of issues here. First off, and that's an error for some. Krieger, the fact is that that person on the rollerblades, first off, would be a question, is it a vehicle under the Motor Vehicle Code? And let me read that. Vehicle means any device in upon which any person or property is or may be transported or drawn upon a highway. Basically, that's what it is. The other thing is that person would be not causing serious physical injury. The accident may result in serious physical injury to that person.
What if he hits an old lady walking across the street?
Then that's a different question. Yeah. Then the question is, has he caused serious physical injury?
But if it's the skateboard's not a vehicle under the Motor Vehicle Code.
Chair, members of the committee, I don't know. I know a bicycle is a vehicle under the Motor Vehicle Code.
Without lights.
I'm hoping to clarify something here. I think in Representative Krieger's situation, what you're talking about is if, say, the skateboard goes out in front of the car, and it isn't the driver of the car's fault of the accident because the skateboard went out without notice, without being seen, I don't think that driver of the vehicle is going to be found to be careless or reckless.
Correct.
And so under this statute, the driver has to be found careless or reckless in order to be imposed the $12,500 fine.
Yeah, well, two quick little things. One is you're putting all the burden on the driver. All these other people can by negligence, can cause an accident and aren't held accountable at all because they don't have a driver's license or anything. The second thing, just real quickly, in 28 years with the state police, one of my biggest problems I had on the Coast Highway was bicycle adults going down the highway with a foot or two of their vehicle, their handlebars, into the traffic lane. Just recently, going home from Salem here, I almost hit one, which came from the 5 or 6 foot brand new paved portion of the highway to the center of my lane. If there had been a car coming, I'd either had a head on or I'd run right over the top of them. I had stopped on numerous occasions adult bicyclers during that 28 years with the state police and asked them, what are you doing out in the lane when you've got all this room over here? Well, there's some gravel in there, and that's hotter on my tires. We need to do a lot better job taking care of the bicyclers before we put all this burden on the drivers.
Representative Krieger, we have a number of people who have signed up to testify in the bill, and I want to make sure we have an opportunity to hear them.
Quick clarification.
Briefly,
it is very brief, Mr. Chair,
question.
And I will ask you or I'll ask counsel. Counsel just stated that under the code, a bicycle is considered a motor vehicle, but in this bill, they are also considered a vulnerable user of a public highway.
Chair, members of the committee, that's correct.
So they get to fit both categories. Thank you.
Okay. We have Ray Thomas signed up. Mr. Thomas. And it says Ray Thomas and panel. Do you have others to accompany you?
Yes. Good morning.
It's going to be very brief. We're going to hear very briefly. So are there people who could come up maybe at the same time with you?
All right, yes. With the assistance of a chair, we'll please come up. My name is Ray Thomas. I live at 37395 Southwest Blooming Fern Hill Road in Cornelius, Oregon. I'm an attorney in Portland. I represent bicyclists and other non-motorized users. And I am here with three witnesses who all share several important characteristics that I think illustrate and hope will be helpful for you in giving you some background about why it is that we need this bill, which, first of all, is not triggered unless there is a vehicle that is involved in an injury where there is carelessness or recklessness involved, and that is the trigger for it. It does not involve non-vehicles such as a skateboard or a rollerblader, but it does provide that it gives folks who are the vulnerable users on the roadway who are not encased in steel some protection so that if they are hurt by the carelessness or the recklessness of a driver or an operator of a bicycle, there's something that is a charging alternative for our law enforcement officers. And I'm just going to give you a very brief introduction and then turn it over to the three layperson witnesses, because what they share is that they each, either in their families or in a child, suffered a catastrophic injury as a result of a collision with a motor vehicle. And in each case, the driver was at fault. It was not a situation where the driver had committed a crime like DUI or a situation where there was an assault or a manslaughter. It was through the carelessness or inattention of a driver that these grievous injuries were caused. And in each case, what the police officers were able to do was very limited, because they were able to cite for the underlying offense, such as an illegal left turn, and for careless driving. But in each of these cases, the Oregon careless driving statute allows a person who's cited not even to go to court. They can send in their check and completely avoid any consequences resulting with court action through the traffic court. And in two of these cases, that's what happened. Further, there's no follow-up for any type of driver's training or improvement or a situation where a judge gets an opportunity to see this person who caused this terrible accident to determine if this person is somebody who's really tracking and able to drive safely in the future to protect other people who are out there. Finally, the what we need to do here is to make it so that we have a situation where charging officers do not have their themselves restricted. If there's a situation that involves an assault or a manslaughter or a criminally negligent homicide, then they have the opportunity to bring somebody within the court system and have some follow-up. But in many instances where somebody is cutting a corner, where they're not paying attention, where they're distracted by something in the car, drivers who are not bad people or necessarily even horrible drivers, if they're in a situation where they seriously injure or kill somebody, there's really no follow-up. So I'd like to introduce to you Gary Jensen, and he is here from Weston, Oregon, and his testimony as well as the testimony from the other two lay witnesses are here for distribution. Thank you.
Yes, Mr. McPherson and the rest of the committee, I appreciate the chance to come here and tell you my story. I got a testimony here, but I'm going to deviate just a little bit after what I heard a little bit ago. My wife had about 9,000 miles on two bikes. We had ridden everywhere in all states. Where she was killed, she was riding, and this is a reconstructionist report, she was riding 6 foot to the right of the fog line. There was eight. The apron there was 8 feet wide. And she was, the eyewitness said that they seen dirt fly before they seen her fly. And that means that the right tire of that car was 9 feet off the road into the bar pit before she hit my wife, killing her. She was driving 62 miles an hour in a 55 mile an hour zone, and she didn't have her seatbelt on. She ended up rolling her car and was unhurt. As you can see from my testimony here, they did, within 4 days, it was published in the paper that she'd been charged and pleaded on the careless driving. $121 is what they decided Marilyn was worth. I don't know what else to say. We've been married nearly 47 years. We're high school sweethearts. She's gone, and my life is, too.
Mr. Jensen, we're very sorry for your loss, and we appreciate your coming in. I know it's very difficult to do that. Our rules require that you identify yourself on the record so we can identify the name. So if you could just...
I'm sorry. My name is Gary Jensen, and I live in Weston, Oregon. It's up in the northeastern part of the state.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Jensen.
Sorry.
Ms. Rawlings.
Thank you, Representative McPherson, members of the committee. My name is Margaret Rawlings. I live in Medford, Oregon. Last spring, my husband, Russ, was riding his bicycle and was struck by a young driver driving a Jeep Wrangler. My husband was in the proper place on the roadway and was wearing his helmet. It was broad daylight. He suffered catastrophic injuries, including traumatic brain injury, also known as TBI, which means it's not something that he will, it doesn't heal up like a broken bone. This has lifelong effects for him. He's 58 years old. He was in great health, and now he probably won't be able to return to work. None of his physicians think he's ready to drive yet. The driver received citations for improper left turn and careless driving. He paid a fine of $1,080 and had no further consequences in traffic court or the criminal justice system. Current law doesn't even require that he appear in court when, in a case like this where these charges are filed, and the judge was not able to suspend his license or mandate community service, which would have been more meaningful for this driver, I believe. If House Bill 3314 was in place when Russ was injured, the driver would be forced to appear personally in court, face a driver's license suspension and fine, or participate in the driver improvement agreement. So I'm asking you, members of the committee, to pass House Bill 3314. Nothing can change the loss that we experienced, but any driver who causes a serious injury of this magnitude must be held accountable. My husband and I will live with the consequences of this driver's actions every day for the rest of our lives, and he paid a fine and continues with his own life. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Rawlings. And we have Dean, I'm not sure I can read this.
Sigler.
Sigler. Thank you, Mr. Sigler.
Chairman McPherson, committee members, my name is Dean Sigler. I'm the grandfather of Jocelyn Lotka. She was 19 years old when she was run down by a monster pickup turning a corner at 39th and Salmon in Portland. The driver was not cited for anything other than careless driving and failing to yield to a pedestrian. He paid a total of $704 in fines, which he mailed in, much like a parking ticket. If HB 3314 were the law, he would at least appear in court, be judged for competency, capability, attitude. He would at least have a review of his ability right there. In Jocelyn's case, we felt that the life that we lost, which was an enormously talented, that of an enormously talented young lady. She was a musician. She played flute, four different types of saxophones. She was learning trombone and guitar. She was a Japanese student and had appeared and competed in many Japanese speech contests. This picture was the last picture I ever took of her. It was taken 2 years ago, December. She had just won a terrific judo match against a far superior opponent who was a black belt. She was a brown belt at the time. And that type of drive, that type of ambition was snuffed out. $704 and no other major consequences to the person who did this seemed terribly unfair to us. I think that this law, because it emphasizes the driver improvement, is of a redemptive character, and I think my granddaughter would approve of that. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Sigler, and thank you all for coming in. I know how difficult it is to come and refresh these
difficult memories. We have one more witness signed up, Lieutenant Mark Kruger from the Portland Police Bureau. And Lieutenant, because we're going to be losing part of our committee here in a few minutes, if you could be as concise as you can. And I do have another person, Jack Evans from ODOT. Mr. Evans, if you could come up, and again, the same request, that you just be very brief because we need to conclude our...
Chairman Pearson, members of the Judiciary Committee, appreciate the opportunity to testify today. My name is Mark Kruger. I'm the Acting Commander of the Portland Police Bureau Traffic Division. I've been a police officer with Portland for 13 years. I've spent more than half of my career in the Traffic Division, so I have fairly extensive experience in traffic enforcement and traffic collision investigation in general. The Portland Police Bureau supports the general concept of this of House Bill 3314 with some caveats. We've worked with the BTA on the on their versions of this, and some of those versions haven't appeared in the final version you have before you hear today. We believe that an enhancement of a violation charge for the death of a road user or the serious physical injury of a death of a road or serious physical injury of a road user would be an excellent tool for an officer when we have cases, and we have a significant number of cases where a simple violation does not seem to suffice and there is no criminal behavior involved in the collision that has occurred. The concerns that the Portland Police Bureau has, however, is that we believe that this type of charge should be available to protect all road users, not just vulnerable road users. In point of fact, far more motorists are killed by the violation actions of other motorists than pedestrians or bicyclists or other road users. And we feel that it is, as an ethical and moral issue, that all Oregonians should be protected as a result of such a violation. It is true and I completely support the sentiments and the intent of the BTA here that road users that are vulnerable, that aren't in a vehicle and whatnot, do suffer a much higher rate of death or serious physical injury when they are involved in collisions, and that there should be some steps there to protect those folks. But additionally, it should apply to all motorists and other road users as well. And how this plays out from a practical standpoint, and what we much prefer in terms of applying this practically, is some sort of an additional enhancement to careless driving. That was BTA's most recent version that we've been working on, where if there is a death or serious physical injury and the violation fits into the careless category, that there would be an enhancement that would include these fines and this requirement that the individual submit to driver improvement training. And I think under those circumstances, this would be very helpful for our officers. We do have, again, we find that these collisions basically fall into three categories. We have collisions that involve a simple violation. They're tragic cases, but they involve a simple violation, a lapse of judgment on the part of the operator. We have slightly more aggravated cases that do fall into the realm of carelessness, and whether you may have a couple violations involved there that result in the death or the serious physical injury. And then we have criminal behavior. We would like to see something that falls in that middle category, where officers will have a tool to hold a driver to a higher level of accountability when there are multiple violations involved that does not rise to the level of criminality, but does indicate a higher level of accountability on the part of the operator. In this case, and we're happy to see that in terms of the suspects in this, it would apply to motorists as well as bicyclists. And to follow up on Representative Krieger's comments, the Portland Police Bureau, we think it's very important that we conduct enforcement across the spectrum of road users, that motorists, pedestrians, and bicyclists, other road users, are held responsible for the traffic laws, and that we encourage the safe use of the roads by all road users. Thank you.
Thank you, Lieutenant Kruger. Mr. Evans.
Chair McPherson, members of the committee, Jack Evans of the Department of Transportation, and I'll be very brief. We picked up a bit of a glitch. We've been working with the Bicycle Transportation Alliance on this measure. Even though we're not taking a position on it, we're prepared to implement it. And in looking at the cost of it associated with the training component, that's going to add an additional $60,000 for us to develop a training component. And we think that the bill can be effectively implemented funded through the private sector without involving ODOT, and thus reducing the cost. And that indeed was the subject of a of the amendments that we put together with Scott Bricker of the BTA. Those amendments didn't show up. So
excuse me, Mr. Evans, have you seen the Dash 2 amendments?
I have not seen the Dash 2, Chair.
And I think that they have been developed in response to that concern. That is, that they have a there's a Section 10 that has a set of fees, that, and so the concept, as I understand it, is that there's a fine established of $12,500, but the driver, the person who commits this offense, can avoid that fine by going into the driver improvement program and paying this much lower fee that would then support the driver improvement program, so that it would in effect offset any fiscal impact on the agency.
Chair McPherson, that's fine, and we can take a look at that and see what that might entail. We had looked at about $60,000 to design and implement the program. Our concern, since we do not do training, our AG has informed us that with that language in Section 4, that might require us to actually perform the training. So as long as we've got that cleared up and we can take a look at this, we may be okay. But I cannot say that definitively right now without having studied this, and I apologize for that.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Evans. Any questions? If not, then I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3314. We're going to roll over the work session on this bill to tomorrow's calendar we'll roll it over to whenever we meet next. Actually, I'm going to go into recess for the benefit of those in the committee, with the possibility of being able to find a time later today, although I have to leave the building at 5 p.m. today, but maybe to see if there's an opportunity for us to get back to continue with this agenda before day's end. I didn't realize we were going to be losing part of our committee here at this hour. So I will we'll be closing the public hearing on House Bill 3314, we'll be going into work session on it either later today or tomorrow if we don't get back to complete our calendar for today. We're down to a bare quorum here, committee, and we have work sessions left on several bills, which I think we probably shouldn't bring back. We shouldn't be trying to cast votes on without more of our committee present. So it's my intention then, unless I hear any objection to that, to go into recess, looking for some time later today when we can get back together.
Maybe from 1 to 3 and 3 to 5.
Well, let's see what we can. We'll see what's possible. I will recess the committee meeting for Monday, April 23.